Faith Middleton, and this show is about the richness of life. We're going to talk about new brain research. Thanks for listening in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York, including the East End of Long Island. This book is mind-blowing. It's called The Brain's Way of Healing. Its author, psychiatric researcher Dr. Norman Deutsch, is with me to explain the latest techniques being used to coax the brain to adapt, change, and even heal in some cases. The new techniques are fascinating and look promising, yet we want to know how far they can take us and those facing traumatic brain injury, concussion, Parkinson's, MS, ADHD, severe depression, autism, and all the other challenges. How far can this take us? You're going to hear about a machine called the PoNS stimulator, laser and light and sound techniques that change the brain. This is the new science of neuroplasticity, the discovery that the brain can change its own structure and function in response to mental experience, including the ones I just mentioned, laser, sound, the stimulator, and other special training techniques. My guest, Dr. Deutsch, who's also written the book, The Brain That Changes, is a psychiatrist, psychoanalyst, and on the faculty at Columbia University, as well as the University of Toronto. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Deutsch.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
Let's start with your description of neuroplasticity in our brains.
Sure. Well, I thought you described it very well. Neuro is for neuron, the nerve cells in the brain that produce the signals in the brain. And plasticity means changeable, adaptable, and modifiable. And neuroplasticity, as you said, is that property of the brain that allows it to change its structure and its function in response to activity, what we do, and all of our mental experiences. And it's a revolutionary discovery, because for the longest time, we believed that the brain circuits were fixed. The brain was seen like an electrical machine, and its circuits were seen to be hardwired. And, you know, machines have parts, and when one part is destroyed, machines do many glorious things, but they don't grow new parts or rewire or reorganize themselves. But now we've discovered that, in fact, the brain is not hardwired. And we can use stimulation even in cases where people have brain problems, brain diseases, brain injuries, to sometimes, and in some kinds of conditions, often rewire the brain and get healthy parts to take over from the parts that are damaged or compromised by disease.
That is so exciting, the idea of this. You reminded me of a scientist we had on the show from the Veterans Administration here in Connecticut, and they had taken a former soldier who had a stroke and had lost the total use of an arm, and he couldn't move it, he felt, no matter what he did, no matter what he said to himself. And so they attached his arm to a machine, and the machine moved his arm for him thousands and thousands of times. And the place in the brain that they looked at and saw had been dead lit up. And other places seemed to be firing too. And suddenly this man could move his arm. I haven't heard anything more about what happened with their experiments, but you've brought that back to me.
Yeah, well, I describe, let me explain what I think is happening there. I describe that kind of thing in detail, mm-hmm. including for people who have had strokes many, many years before and haven't been able to move the arm for decades. So as long as people thought that the brain was fixed, there was what I call this doctrine of the unchanging brain, and it gave rise to a kind of neurological nihilism whenever someone had a stroke or certain kinds of brain injury, because it just seemed that it was pointless to try to do anything. So we didn't encourage that much activity. We encouraged very limited activity, usually around the six-week mark or up to the six-week mark. And that was based on the accurate finding that when a person has a stroke, you know, there's either a blood clot or a bleed, and mm-hmm. all of that blood has to be reabsorbed by the body. And there's lots of inflammation. Cells die. There's chemical leakage in the brain.
Right.
What we find is that even if the stroke was in a small part of the brain, it extends the loss of function is often more global throughout the brain just because of all of this activity. So the person tries to move their arm. Let's say that's where the stroke was, in the part of the brain that governs the arm, and they try to move their leg and they can't. And in that period, they learn that they can't use that limb. And it's not a conscious thing. It doesn't have to do with will. It's just the brain can learn this almost unconsciously. We call this learned non-use. And what I found is that this occurs not only in stroke, where it was discovered, and in lab animals, but in many, many, many brain problems, that the brain just makes some of its circuits go dormant. So dormant is not dead. The neuroplastic brain is a use it or lose it brain. If you don't use it, the circuits basically start to waste away, go dormant, or atrophy and weaken. And so what we find is here's what physicians used to do.
Let me jump in there, because what that sounds like when you get to that part is that only if you intervene early can you make a change, but that's not the case here.
What happens is the circuits go dormant, or they might be taken over for other activities. That's how adaptable the brain is. But they're certainly not used for the original purpose, which is moving the right leg. And so, because physicians just saw that there was this 6-week crisis, it's called diakysis, all that they would do for rehab is they'd wait, till the 6 weeks had gone and see what you could do. They'd give you a little rehab, which is really just to prime the pump and see what was left. And then they'd tell you, look, this is what's left. You might make some meager progress in the next 6 months or a year, but that's it. And these new techniques can be commenced years later or a year later. And, for instance, one that I describe in my first book involves let's say the person had a stroke that affected their right arm. What they will tend to do because of learned non-use is use their left arm a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
What you do is you take that left arm and you put it in a cast or a sling so they can't use it, and you incrementally train that movement of that weakened arm using children's toys, doing the very simplest movements. I mean, if they can just quiver their fingers, you start working with that, and you train that up very intensively for 2 weeks, and then they have to go home and do their training. And they've got to keep that sling or cast on. And that work done by the Taub Clinic, T-A-U-B, in Birmingham, Alabama, at the university there, has literally restored hundreds and hundreds of people. And there are about 400 studies on this treatment.
Yeah.
And so that can be applied also to other kinds of problems, like cerebral palsy. But we can use the principle of learned non-use to apply to Parkinson's and other difficulties.
Hmm. Here's the balance for me doing a show like this. And I'm sure this was true for you in writing your book. I'm trying, on the one hand, to stay open to the new here, and it's so exciting as I read your book. It's just mind-blowing to me. But on the other hand, I want to be careful not to give false hope or to say that every single person can be cured of every single thing.
That makes two of us.
Yeah. So how do we position this?
Well, we're talking about the brain. It's the most complex object in the universe. That's number one. Number two, everybody's different. Every brain problem is different. So what I do is I talk about principles that have been helpful to people. But for instance, let's say I'm talking about traumatic brain injury, and there are 5 new interventions for traumatic brain injury in the book.
Mm-hmm.
The conventional treatment for traumatic brain injury is just basically rest, and you hope the person gets better. We now discover there are a whole bunch of different approaches we can take as we understand more about the brain to help people who have not gotten better. But no two brain injuries are identical, right? Let's think about it. Two people get in a car accident. One person was physically fit, didn't drink, bright, took care of themselves, ate well. The other person, and they're hit in one part of the head. The other person's hit in two parts of the head, different parts. They've been abusing drugs, haven't gotten off the couch in years, probably have a little bit of fatty buildup in their blood vessels because they're not watching what they eat. They're going to be very different people, and psychologically they're different. But, I mean, physicians know this. We all know this. It's not too hard to take these things into account. You know, there are two things we have to worry about. It's not just false hope. We also have to worry about false despair. They're both, you know, the world's more complicated than just having to worry about false hope.
Mm-hmm.
False despair can be devastating in conditions where activity is necessary, where the patient's involvement in their own getting better is one, very important aspect of the improvement. And I think that we have just lived through about 100 years where we've tended to err on this neurological nihilism side.
Mm-hmm.
So my job, as I see it, is not to show that everybody can be helped all the time. That's ridiculous. Nothing in life, and certainly nothing in medicine that I've ever seen, helps everybody all the time. But where people have been saying that nothing will work, there's nothing you can do if you've had a concussion and haven't spontaneously recovered. There's nothing you can do if you have Parkinson's disease and get that diagnosis, or MS, et cetera, except take your medicine. I think it's really important to point out these cases which show that that's not true. Those cases cause us to have to go back to the drawing board and re-examine this doctrine of the unchanging brain. So I believe that that unintentionally has done has led to a lot of people not getting better. Because, you know, let's say you have a stroke and you plateau. Because it's a use it or use it brain, you don't just plateau, actually. You get more and more restricted over time. So if you don't make the effort to use that limb, which has, you know, been damaged, and of course it's not just you by yourself, but with the proper professionals guiding you how to do it, then it starts to waste away. The muscles start to waste away, and so on. So I live with this whole issue of getting the balance right between false hope and false despair every day of my life. I take it really seriously. I see false hope and false despair is like two evil twins that are competing to do harm.
Yeah, that's so good. Psychiatrist and research analyst Dr. Norman Doidge of Columbia University, author of The Brain's Way of Healing, about new techniques to rev up the brain's neuroplasticity, the ability of the brain to change itself, even facing these great challenges. What does this mean for concussion, ADHD, depression, autism, traumatic brain injury, Parkinson's, MS? You know the list. This is an area of research to keep an eye on and a great way to cruise through what is happening right now. And I think incredibly hopeful, this book, The Brain's Way of Healing. Stay with us, Dr. Doidge. We're going to take a very short break, and then I want to continue our conversation and talk about this PoNS machine that they are using on people. Stay here. I'm Faith Middleton. It is a pleasure to have my guest on the show, psychiatrist and research analyst Dr. Norman Doidge of Columbia University. He has spent the last several years since his last best-selling book going all over the world talking to people to see what is happening in terms of neuroplasticity, the brain's ability to heal itself, to change. And these techniques are being used around the world. And word is just getting out and will really get out now because of this book. So, Dr. Doidge, there's a machine that is used. It is, I call it the PoNS. Am I saying that correctly? The PoNS
exactly,
machine?
Yeah.
Okay, so that stands for Portable Neuromodulation Stimulator, PONS. And you say that it's a device that resets the neuroplastic brain that we all have, and it modifies and corrects how our neurons are firing. And that can, in turn, reduce or even, in some cases, reverse symptoms of all those things that plague us in the brain.
Of a number of things, not all, but sure. Here's one of the things that I have observed occurs in many, many forms of brain injury or brain damage is the following. The brain becomes noisy, and it fires irregular signals. You know, for the longest time, we haven't paid enough attention to this. We sort of thought that when there's brain damage or disease, it's as though a part of the brain is destroyed and nothing can do to make it better. And we've judged that often by the loss of function. So if a person, let's go back to a stroke, had a stroke, and they lost 90% of the function of their right leg, there was a tendency during the period of the time that we believed that the brain was fixed to assume that 90% of the brain cells that move the leg or the tracks that carry signals from those cells must also be destroyed. But that's not really what happens, I believe, in the brain. And what I am saying is based on studying the electrophysiology of the brain using quantitative EEGs and so on. What I think usually happens is this. When there's brain disease or damage, some cells do die, and then they stop firing any signals whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
But other cells were receiving signals from those cells, and they suddenly have no input, so they're not functioning well. Other cells are sick, and instead of firing at a normal rate, they fired at an abnormal rate. And so they're not much use, and they create a lot of noise in the brain, and some of the surviving healthy cells receive those noisy signals, so they can't function well. The brain is now functioning like a radio that's kind of slightly off-channel. Its signals are not strong and clear, and the net result is the person can't perform their functions well, and yet only a few of their cells are dead. So the question becomes, can we synchronize the sick cells and the healthy cells? And this device called the PONS does that. So
how does it do it?
Okay, well, let me describe it. It's really small. It's got something about the size of a stick of chewing gum that has 144 very, very small little metal dots on it, which are electrodes, and it generates a particular kind of wave that talks to the brain in its own language, which is the language of electrical firing, and it works this way. You put it in your mouth. It's a portable device, and because the tongue is moist, it receives stimulation that just turns on the touch receptors in the tongue. So this is not shocking your brain. It's not sending electricity into your brain. It's just giving enough stimulation to turn on the touch receptors in the tongue. It feels like you're swirling champagne. That's the level of stimulation.
Huh. And why is the tongue considered the pathway to the brain?
Because the tongue sits only an inch and a half neuroanatomically in front of the deepest part of your brain. And there are 15,000 nerve pathways that go right into that deep part of the brain called the brainstem. They convey touch, taste, and so on, right to the deepest part of your brain. And so it's a way to talk to that part of the brain. Now, that deep part of the brain is called the brainstem. And the brainstem, it's a little bit bigger than your thumb, but it houses the parts of the brain that do all sorts of kinds of regulation. It regulates your temperature. It regulates your autonomic nervous system. It regulates a nerve that's involved in your immune system. And when these things, it regulates your balance. It helps in part to integrate sensation and movement and so on. So it's an incredibly important part of the brain. And when I say regulates, what I mean is, let's take temperature. Just as in the room, you know, there's a thermostat that makes sure that the room stays at the optimal level. Let's say it's, 70 degrees. So your body has to stay at an optimal level to function well. So that's called homeostasis in science. And the brainstem is filled with these homeostatic regulators. And they go awry in many, many different brain problems. So people's movement is poorly regulated. They get clumsy. Their balance is clumsy. Let's say someone with a brain injury, but this applies to MS, Parkinson's, you know, sensations inappropriate, and so on. And we found the right wave to turn that noisy brain off and get the brain firing at a regular rate, which is why they can get a very rapid diminishment of symptoms, even though, you know, they still have Parkinson's, they still have MS and so on. So the symptoms go away without the need for medication to improve them. The people still may be on their medications, but many of these medications fail over time. In some situations, like Mary Gaines, who I describe in the book, who had a stroke and couldn't speak, using the PoNS for about, I think it was about 18 months, after rehab only got her so far, allowed her to completely improve her speech, and she doesn't have to use it anymore.
Yeah, so how would you explain that, MS patients and their neurologists, or Parkinson's patients and their neurologists, are not racing to these machines to cure themselves or lessen their symptoms? Why is that not happening?
Well, my book's the first book that's ever been written on this, on the PoNS. This is all new. They may well be racing very soon. What has happened, but it does go deeper than that. This is an energy-based intervention. I have other energy-based interventions that use low-intensity lasers for traumatic brain injury or migraine, which low-intensity lasers are unlike high-intensity lasers, which destroy flesh. Low-intensity lasers promote healing, or sound for autism that we could talk about. And, you know, Western medicine hasn't focused a lot in neurology and psychiatry on these energy-based interventions. It's been much more focused on the use of medication. And the reason is that for the doctrine of the unchanging brain was established for so long that it's only now that people are beginning to realize how much you can do. You know, the discovery that the brain is plastic came out of neuroscience labs. We had to be able to make microscopic movies of the brain changing as learning occurred. And it's now mainstream in neuroscience that the brain is plastic. But it takes a while for things to roll out clinically. And, you know, I do want to say a couple of things about this. You know, the question is a very reasonable question, but it underestimates how new the discovery of the PoNS is. And, you know, we tend to assume that we live in a kind of a medical utopia where all new treatments, you know, become immediately available and distributed throughout society rapidly.
Right.
But clinicians have to be taught right now as well. The PoNS is in the hands of the U.S. government in a huge study of veterans who have had traumatic brain injury. It's being studied at the Montreal Neurological Institute for MS and a few other places in the world. So it's very new, but I've been following this lab since 2003, which has given me the confidence to talk about this because I've followed so many of their patients for so long.
Yeah, this is, as you can hear this conversation, you see why I find this information mind-blowing. So the book is called The Brain's Way of Healing, and I am with psychiatrist and psychiatric researcher Norman Doidge, who is a doctor and also on the faculty at Columbia and in Toronto. Does this, when you describe what the brainstem does and deep inside and the tongue's proximity to it and how this PoNS machine stimulating across the tongue in these ways affects the brain and the neurons, does this go down to the smallest level? People with super high blood pressure having it affected this way, people with super low blood pressure having it affected by something like a PoNS machine?
You know, that's a very good question, and I don't know the answer to that. What I do know is that, in other words, I don't know if they've looked at normalizing of blood pressure, but I can say this much. Most people, when they're using the PoNS, I want to emphasize, all they experience is a gentle stimulation that's very much like champagne bubbles, and they're asked to stand quietly and meditate to calm themselves if they're feeling jittery, or and to have balance problems, or they use it while they're walking if they have movement problems, or they use it while they're humming if they're someone with MS with voice problems. So we couple it with an exercise and the use of the device. But what we universally see is if they stand still, even if they come in and they look like, frankly, a nervous wreck because they've had a brain injury and they're overstimulated and by light and sound and exhausted, as so many people with neurological conditions are, when they put the device in their mouth, somewhere between 13 and 17 minutes, they look unbelievably calm. And what is happening is their fight-or-flight system is turned off, and what is called the parasympathetic system is turned on. The parasympathetic system is involved. Fight or flight is when you sort of run for your life, and it's a survival technique, of course. The parasympathetic turns off that fight or flight system, but it also is the system for rest, digestion, and healing. And when we're very, very in a deep, deep calm, think about the best massage you've ever had or a meditative state, the parasympathetic system's always on. And that does tend to lower blood pressure. I don't know what the PONS would do if you had already had low blood pressure.
Yeah.
But it might help you re-regulate it. I don't know.
Yeah, reset. So let's go to autism for a second, because in my experience, when I have seen people who have been somewhere on the autistic spectrum, some appear to have the capacity to integrate more easily into society and take on behaviors that would make that a fit. Others, not so much. The profound autism is what I would call it. So how are these techniques effective with people who have autism?
Alongside other interventions, such as, let me say a few words about autism. The short answer is yes. And what I'm about to say about autism applies even more to learning disorders of various kinds, and attention deficit disorder, and sensory processing disorders. But let's go to autism. For the longest time we talked about autism as a brain disease. That's not quite right. Autism is a whole body disease, which also affects the brain. Children with autism tend to have inflammation throughout their bodies, and it has a devastating impact on their brain as it develops, and it causes it to not connect up properly.
Mm-hmm.
Some areas are overconnected, some areas are underconnected. One of the areas that's underconnected is the parts of the brain that process sound and language are underconnected to the pleasure centers in the brain. Now, because there's so much inflammation in autistic children, I believe you always have to work at several levels. And one of them is you have to investigate their diet and their metabolism and previous exposures to toxins, because we now have numerous cases of people who've improved with modifications of these. Something is provoking that inflammation throughout the body. And this is, by the way, this has been shown in many studies, and we definitely know the autistic brain is a very inflamed brain in many autistic kids. Okay, you may have noticed that autistic children very frequently are hypersensitive to sound.
Right.
Go to an airport where they have one of those noisy, moving, flat, sort of escalator-like things, and that is terrifying to them. But go to many places where there's noise, and autistic children will be covering their ears, screaming in distress. They're deeply tormented. They can yell and scream. They can bite in response to that. Sometimes they just withdraw and do funny movements. Okay, so why is that going on? Well, in people who don't have autism and don't have any kind of listening or hearing problem, those of us who are so blessed basically have something that's like an auditory zoom in our ears. Just as a camera has a zoom lens, the ear has an auditory zoom. When you walk into a noisy party, at first it's booming, buzzing, confusion. But then that zoom kicks in and you start to hear a few conversations and you make out, oh, that's one's about politics and that's about religion and that's about sports and so on. Your zoom focuses in on the frequencies of human speech and into particular frequencies. Now, autistic children can't do that. But they often hear another kind of frequency, and it's a low frequency, which is very disturbing. Now, these low frequencies are the kinds of things that a lot of machines make, refrigerators. It's the kind of frequency that filmmakers put into their films, you know, when an alien takes over and it sends a chill down your spine, or when, you know, the shark comes on in Jaws. So think about it. These autistic kids, they can't make out human speech, and they're hearing low-threatening sounds. That turns on their fight-or-flight mechanism. It's on all the time. And what they do is they learn to withdraw and try to turn it off, or they live with that torment. The brain interventions that I describe that use sound take music or even the child's mother's voice and modifies the frequencies very, very subtly, favoring the ones initially that the autistic children can tolerate, and then moving them into the ones that are a little harder to tolerate. And just as you're building a muscle by doing exercise, it builds up that auditory zoo. It quiets the noisy brain of the autistic child. And it can happen very rapidly. It can be stunning. I described Timothy in the book, who had moderate to severe autism. He was temper tantruming. At 18 months, something happened. His mother says he fell away from us. His speech development stopped and regressed. He stopped making eye contact. He had temper tantrums and started treating his parents like things as opposed to other people. And he was supposed to be institutionalized. They lost their relationship with him. And luckily, his mother heard about this place in Toronto that uses this treatment. It's called the Listening Center. And I describe it at length. And after a couple of days, his grandmother said while he was going home, you know, there's something different about Timothy today. I can't put my finger on it. The next day, Timothy hugged his father spontaneously for the first time. Now, what's happening here? We're training the Zoom and using other ways of talking to the brain through sound. Now, how does that work? Basically, our senses are called transducers in engineering terms. A transducer basically turns energy of one form into another form, and it can turn the patterns of information and energy of one form into another form. Right now, I am talking into a transducer. My voice, sound waves are being turned into electrical signals, and I'm talking into a microphone, and you're hearing me through another transducer, which is turning electrical signals into sound waves. Well, that's all that our ears do. But the treatments I describe that are non-invasive find ways of using natural forms of energy to talk to the brain to change how it wires itself, because it's plastic, and to wire it or drive it in a very healthy direction with slow incremental practice. So Timothy, you know, hugged his dad, and if I can just say, this boy who couldn't speak, you know, just graduated from high school with an A in English, has had friends and a relationship with his parents, was restored, and he's on track to go to university.
Yeah. Dr. Deutsch, please stay where you are. I'm so sorry I have to take a break, but I do. I'm having a quick event to tell you, to tell our listeners about, and then we'll come back and talk more about this book. What does this mean for, say, depression or even blindness or dementia and Alzheimer's? We'll get into all that. The book is called The Brain's Way of Healing, and we'll be right back. We'll be right back. That's the Tim Moran Quartet. I am a longtime fan of his music. If you are energized, as I am, by hard-swinging, adventurous, yet accessible jazz, check this out. See the one-night-only performance of the Tim Moran Quartet, featuring standards from the American Songbook, including bossa nova, jazz, and some original compositions, with an emphasis on what makes jazz the magic that it is, especially in this group's hands, fabulous improvisation. In addition to Moran on alto sax, the quartet includes Jesse Hameen on drums, Jeff Fuller on bass, and Tony Lombardozzi on guitar. That is one talented crew. Ticket and concert information is posted right now at our site, The Faith Middleton Show at WNPR.org. The concert takes place Tuesday, April 7th at 7 p.m. at Nelson Hall for the Performing Arts at Elam Park on Cook Hill Road in Cheshire, Connecticut. My guest on this show, psychiatrist and research analyst Dr. Norman Doidge of Columbia University, author of The Brain's Way of Healing, a new book about new techniques to rev up the brain's neuroplasticity, ability to change itself when challenged in a variety of ways. We think about Parkinson's and MS and stroke and traumatic brain injury and ADHD, depression, and on it goes. What does it mean for all these things? This is an area of research to keep an eye on and to find out what's happening, because that's what Dr. Doidge has done as a psychiatrist and psychiatric researcher. He's gone all over the world to check in on the latest, and it is something. So, Dr. Doidge, let's continue with dementia and Alzheimer's. These are, of course, different things, and there are so many forms of dementia, but people are interested now, fearful that they're going to either develop Alzheimer's or some form of dementia, you know, buying these brain games, eating certain ways. Some people have it in the family. In terms of these new therapies that you've been studying, what do we know?
Well, the good news is about decreasing risk of dementia, including Alzheimer's. I have not written that there are cures for Alzheimer's. There are a few promising things, but I'm not writing a book about promising things. I'm writing a book about things that have basically arrived. And so the big news happened about just over a year ago, and it has not gotten nearly enough attention in the media, because we've always assumed that the breakthroughs for Alzheimer's would come from very, very high-tech research and medications and so on. But just over a year ago, a group in Wales, called which is affiliated with what's called the Cochrane Institute, which is an extremely esteemed research group. Physicians listening in on the program will know it's considered to be the gold standard in analyzing studies, published a 30-year-long study, parts of which were originally designed by Archibald Cochrane, who was called the father of evidence-based medicine. And they followed over 2,200 men in a village in Wales for these 30 years as they did five healthy behaviors. These healthy behaviors were basically what were thought to be healthy behaviors 30 years ago. So it started about 1979. That was when the thing started to roll out. And if they did four of these five healthy behaviors, the risk for dementia decreased by a staggering 60% in these men. Now, if there's any pill out there that reduced the risk of dementia by 60%, it would be the most talked about pill on the planet, I suggest.
Yeah.
So this study got some play, but I think it didn't get more play, again, because of the doctrine of the unchanging brain and the fact that people don't understand how adaptable and modifiable the brain is over time by activity, which is, you know, the definition of what plasticity is.
So what are the healthy
behaviors? So the number one thing, you have to do four of these five, but the number one most powerful thing was exercise. It wasn't brutal CrossFitness. It was men who walked to work a mile and walked home a mile or more. But if you walked 15 minutes to work and 15 minutes back, and you did it steadily over time, or you rode your bike 10 miles a day, 5 days a week, or did regular vigorous exercise. That was enough to qualify for the exercise component. The next most and I'm going to explain in a minute why that's a neuroplastic intervention. The next most important thing was not smoking, then eating a lot of fruits and vegetables, like I think it was 3 to 4 portions a day, in other words, avoiding processed foods and having, you know, real food. Being within your normal weight, defined by a BMI of 18 to just under 25, and not drinking more than a glass of wine a day, which is not to recommend that everybody drink a glass of wine a day. It's just saying if you drank more than a glass of wine every day, you would that would not help you lower risk. Not only did those five activities lower the risk of dementia by 60%, they lowered the risk of early death by all causes by 60%, and lowered the risk of stroke, diabetes, and heart disease by 50%. So much of this is in our control. We're told frequently that Alzheimer has genetic risk factors, but the fact of the matter is that it's only in about 5% of people who get the very early dementias that the risk factors are, exceptionally powerful. In the rest of people, you could have strong risk factors for dementia and still not get dementia. In fact, I would argue that for a person who has risk factors, these activities are even more important, not less important.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not nature or nurture in 95% of cases. It's, you know, getting the mix right. Now, for listeners, all these five things have something in common. They all require that we live more according to nature before the industrialized world arrived. Exercise is about not moving around in machines all day, but using your body and keeping it active. Smoking and drinking are inventions. Drinking is a very ancient invention, but it's an invention. Smoking, perhaps less so. Processed foods are inventions. And our ancestors, if you see pictures of people who lived in various tribes or still do, you can see their ribs. Their weight in general is what we would now call a normal weight, an ideal weight. So they're all subtractive, taking away influences that modernity has introduced into our lives that give us short-term convenience and long-term problems. Now, why exercise? For 100 years, we could not find any evidence that there were stem cells in the brain, those little baby cells that can become like replacement parts if cells are damaged. And then in 1998, we discovered them. They were discovered by a team, and one of the members of the team was Frederick Gage. And we've also since discovered that when you move, you make brain growth factors that help, they function like fertilizer in the brain. They help the connections in the brain to grow, and they keep the infrastructure of the brain healthy. Now, Frederick Gage, also with one of his team members, discovered that a way to generate these baby stem cells in the brain was walking, exercise. And he asked himself, why is this? And he said to himself, well, when does an animal go on a really long walk? And it's when it's fleeing or leaving its existing environment because there's an absence of food or water, or there's a new predator, and it leaves an area that it's explored very carefully and learned about every nook and cranny to go to a new unexplored territory. And so it seems what's happening is the exertion of the body is signaling to the brain that there's going to be a lot of learning to be done as the animal arrives at the new unexplored territory.
Mm-hmm.
And so more brain fertilizer or growth factors and new cells, particularly, and the cells are focused in one area called the hippocampus, which turns short-term memories, things you've just learned, into long-term memories. So that's why exercise, even though it's a bodily function, is so important for the brain.
Yeah, I get it. So in terms of, this is Dr. Norman Doidge, author of The Brain's Way of Healing, brand new book about quite remarkable discoveries and recoveries from the frontier of neuroplasticity, the brain's ability to heal itself and change from stimuli. These are techniques that are now being used around the world to get people's challenges in line in ways that we had not thought possible. In some cases, completely healing. Dr. Doidge, I think about the numbers of people who are on antidepressants. This is a multi-billion dollar industry. How do these techniques of, say, the PoNS machine and light and sound therapy, how do these have the potential in terms of neuroplasticity to affect depression?
Well, in some forms of depression, there is a noisy brain going on. So they can help to normalize that. The PoNS hasn't been studied in depth for depression, but what we've noticed is that a lot of people have an improved mood with the PoNS. I'm not recommending the PoNS for depression yet because I just haven't seen enough evidence of it. I've seen evidence of it for these other disorders I've described. The same with light. There's just only been a few studies of light and depression, but of course we've known that mood is very influenced by light. We use very specific frequencies. It's been known for quite some time that patients who have seasonal affective disorder respond to light, but low-intensity lasers seem helpful. But that's, again, in the promising category. Most of my book is about things that people have already accomplished. But I do want to say this much. You know, psychiatry has had different eras. In the first era, everybody got psychotherapy because we didn't really have many medications. Then we developed medications and psychotherapy. And recently, for financial reasons driven by insurance companies and so on, and doctors not having time with patients, there's, in psychiatry, people are pressured to use only medication. I actually think that there was a golden age of psychiatry when people had options to use psychotherapy as well. And now with brain scan studies, we know that some mainstream psychotherapies, including psychodynamic psychotherapy, which is a kind of psychoanalytic psychotherapy, cognitive behavior psychotherapy, interpersonal psychotherapy, and a couple of others, including mindfulness meditation, all change the brain. We can see neuroplastic change happening. We can see the psychotherapy driving not only change in the brain, but improvement in symptoms. So I just wish to put in a word for psychotherapy, which in fact is a neuroplastic intervention.
And I guess I've seen a lot of research that the two combined, in some cases medication plus psychotherapy, large effect there. We have about a minute to go, and what I wish the most is that I had another hour to talk with you about the findings in your book. There are so many stories here about individual patients, what happened to them as a result of these new therapies, and it's really quite something. I want to talk more about the PoNS machine. I hope you'll be a guest again. I also wanted to ask you whether you believed, as a psychiatrist, whether, as in mindfulness, there is a no self or there is a unique original self in everyone. So maybe we'll get to that on your next visit on the show.
That's a very important, profound question.
Thank you very, very much for writing this book. It's just fascinating. Thank you.
Well, thank you for your interest. I hope it helps a lot of people.
Okay, me too. The Brain's Way of Healing by Norman Doidge. Information about it is on our website, The Faith Middleton Show. As always, this show is about the richness of life. You can find the books, people, everything at our website, as promised. In New Haven, I'm Faith Middleton.